Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Oklahoma House District 26 Candidate Forum. We are PAVE, the Pottawatomie County Advocates for Voter Education. Our forums and procedures are based on the League of Women Voters and are nonpartisan. Questions are submitted by our community and screened for duplications and appropriateness. We may combine questions that address the same issue. Many of the members of our organization have been with us for 20 years, and some of us are new conscripts, and we're always looking for new members. The election is going to be on Tuesday, November 5th. Make sure you show up for that. After drawing straws, Carrie Keck will go first with an opening statement, and then Del Kerbs will do a closing statement first. So, Carrie Keck.
Good morning. Good evening. It's not morning. Good evening. Long day. Thank you to the members of the PAVE Forum for hosting this community forum and for everyone that took the time out of their evening to come and hear from both of your candidates. My name is Carrie Keck, and I am the Democratic candidate for State House District 26. I am a 23-year Army veteran and a resident of Shawnee. I love this community. I grew up here in a small house across the street from the YMCA. And I am proud to be, I went to Shawnee Public Schools, but I'm a proud Dell Pirate. I graduated in 1996. I served in the Army for 23 years, as I mentioned, and after my husband and I retired, we just wanted to come back home. And Shawnee's always felt like home to me, and this is a place that I naturally gravitated to. Now I'd just really like to serve our community as our state representative.
All right, thank you. Dell Kerbs.
Well, thanks everybody for coming out this evening, and I appreciate PAVE for putting on the forum this evening. Many of you know me. I've served as your House of Representatives for the last 8 years. Resident here in Shawnee for well over 25 years, raised both of my daughters here, wonderful girls, been involved in FFA and band, CEF, just been out in the community doing all the great things that we do. Also on the Coney Island here downtown, so if you haven't had a great hot dog, come on down. You'll enjoy that. It's a great opportunity to live in Shawnee, to serve the Shawnee folks, and just raise a family here. And as we continue to move forward, we're going to move forward together as a community. And I'm really excited to get into the questions and see what we've got to go. So with that.
All right. So I'm going to start off the questions. And the first one, I'll go to Del Kerbs first. As candidates for House District 26, you have distinctly different career experiences. What about your respective careers and leadership abilities makes you best qualified to benefit this district at the state capitol?
Well, appreciate the question. For me, I look at it as a business component. I've owned a business, been in the community long before I even ran for office. Then the decision came, had folks come to me and ask me to run for this position. And I chose to put my name on the ballot. After that, I was elected, learned a lot in the state, and still continue to learn a lot as the representative, and continue to do so throughout the time. My business experience, understanding what your community deals with on a day-to-day basis and what your folks in the community deal with, is always a challenge. You know, the interesting thing is I talk to people all the time. You've got a lot more small businesses than you do big business. And so it's a challenge for those small businesses to stay in operation on it, especially with everything that's going on right now in the economy and the increase. It's also a challenge in the households. So anything and everything that we can do at the state level to be able to help alleviate those pains that we're having on a day-to-day basis on our finances and the economy is what we want to look at doing. And as we continue to work through those processes and be able to do things, we are moving together, all together, one step at a time. So, you know, just the experiences of being a business owner, volunteering, working with our community throughout the time, that prior to, during, and now continuing to do those things, gives me the experience I feel that I can continue to move forward as your state representative.
Okay, thank you. Carrie Keck.
Thank you again for the question. We need leadership in our elected officials, and through over two decades of military service, serving in organizations as small as 15 and as large as 500, I have that experience, the leadership experience that we need in a representative. I deployed twice to Afghanistan, and so I really know the importance of good leadership, and I understand the necessity of working together as a team to accomplish the mission. I service to our country really prepared me for the challenges that I will face in our legislature. And more than anything, I'm not a politician, but I chose to run because I want to serve this community and be a part of the solution.
Okay, thank you. Our next question, I'll go first to Carrie Keck. Would you support a cost of living adjustment for retired educators?
Well, I really think that we can't do enough to support teachers, and that includes retired educators. They are critical to both our economy because they help our workforce and our children. They educate our children, which is our future workforce, and they sacrifice themselves almost on a daily basis. I've spoken to so many teachers in our community and support staff that have stories of just having to use their own money and their own funds to pay for supplies in the classroom. And as far as retired educators as well, they still serve in their community and do a lot for their community. And so the sacrifices that they made, both taking time out of their personal lives to focus on educating our kids, I think deserve is well deserving of a cost of living increase. And it makes sense. We give cost of living increases for our military personnel who serve our country. Why not give cost of living increases for our teachers who serve our community and our children?
Thank you. Del Kerbs, would you support a cost of living adjustment for retired educators?
Absolutely. We've actually run the actuaries on the retirement plan to look at making sure that we can sustain that and continue to look at doing what we need to do to take care of our retired teachers and our existing teachers as they are in the classroom. Over the last 8 years that I've been in office, we have funded over $1 billion in new money into education and continue, even when the state was in revenue failure. We continued to hold education harmless because we feel that that's an important factor in education and in building the foundation for our kids. So moving that forward, the actuaries have come back that says we can sustain an increase on that. And so as we continue to look at those, what can we sustain and continue to do that to make sure that the pension system is shored up and continues to be able to fund teacher retirement? Because teacher retirement is a defined benefit, not a contributed benefit. So it makes it a real challenge sometimes to make sure that you keep that very solid. Over the years, previous administrations have pulled money out of those pension systems and caused them not to be as stable. We're now, I do believe that the teacher pension system is pushing close to 80%. It's in the upper 70s on there, and as we want to get to fully funded, in those, that makes it a lot easier to give higher COLAs and do those kind of things. So as we continue to look at those, we want to make sure that the structure base is solid to sustain them and then continue to do those.
Okay. Thank you. Next question, first to Del Kerbs. Unlike this race, many races are decided in the primaries because there are no candidates in the opposing party. Would you support an open primary for races that are unopposed to help protect our representative democracy?
That's always an interesting question. It's always a debate we have. We have parties for a reason. You have a Democratic Party, you have a Republican Party, you have an Independent, and you have a Liberal. And so I think it's important as you go through the primaries that those are the defining numbers on there. So to answer the question directly, no, on the primary side. But you have open voting when it comes to the general, which is what it comes down to. That's what your opportunity is this evening, is to see which way you're going to vote, which candidate you're going to vote for. So you have that opportunity. So that's my answer to that.
Okay. Carrie Keck, would you support an open primary for races that are unopposed to help protect our representative democracy?
I absolutely would support an open primary system. Currently, as a Democrat, I wasn't able to vote on the majority of the positions that were on the ballot in our primary here in Pottawatomie County and here in Shawnee. And that means that so many people in our community and in our state with closed primaries, so many people in our state are not represented. They don't have a voice in the positions that the taxpayer dollar, the money I'm paying out of my taxpayer dollars are funding. I think that closed primaries also contribute to extreme partisanship. They ensure that candidates can really just appeal to their base, and that's the only people that they have to appeal to. So they have no incentive to address the concerns or challenges that people in the opposing party face. And regardless of what party you are, regardless of whether I'm a Democrat and Dell is a Republican or anybody else in this room, I will be the candidate that supports all, that listens to all the people in our community and represents everyone, regardless of your party. Because the reality is we have to work together in the legislature, here in our community, and in our state legislature, we have got to work together to address the challenges we have. And really, I'm tired of the partisanship. I'm sure the majority of you are as well. So.
Thank you. All right, next question, first for Carrie Keck. Where do you stand on the current mandate from the State Department of Education requiring schools to add theologically based curriculum in all classrooms in grades 5 through 12 and its constitutionality?
Well, you know, our school curriculum already requires the Bible to be a part of the curriculum, right? It's already a document that's utilized. So in the Bibles are already available in our libraries. So that's already an issue, right? But for me as a parent and me who grew up in a household that, in a Christian household, my parents were the ones that were responsible for my religious education, right, in my church. So I think that's where the Bible should be. The Bible in our Constitution separates church and state for a reason. We can't focus on one religion over the other, and I think that using taxpayer dollars to fund Bibles in schools is really not the best use of our funds when we could be using that money to pay for free meals for kids in schools instead.
Okay. Doe Kerbs, where do you stand on the current mandate from the State Department of Education requiring schools to add theologically based curriculum in all classrooms in grades 5 through 12 and its constitutionality?
Well, I think this is one area that we're probably going to agree a little more on. I think there's a lot of challenges when you talk about bringing the Bible into the classroom. And when I say challenges, it's not that we're afraid of the Bible or anything of that nature. And how we use it in historical reference is great. But there are challenges when you talk about teaching out of the Bible. That's a double-edged sword both ways. So you have to be real careful of that. And I think there's going to be a lot of our teachers that are not going to be comfortable with that, with having that mandate put on them. So we're still going to have some challenges as that comes forth in the next legislative session to work through that process and figure out what are we actually talking about. Those the mandate that's come down from the State Department of Ed, he being Ryan Walters, our state superintendent, is coming to the legislature to ask for some of the possible money of up to $3 million to fund to purchase these Bibles. And that's a concern because, again, the libraries already have those in there. They already have that in the school. And are we crossing over that state and church? I've had many conversations with pastors, both my pastor and other pastors, as well as the monks out at St. Gregory's. And it's the same kind of feeling. You know, I think the concept is good, but let's see how we're talking about executing this before we actually start condemning or chastising the whole system from the teachers all the way up on ways to not do this or do this. We've got to be steadfast and steady in making sure of which way we're going to go with this in this direction.
Okay, thank you. Next question, first for Del Kerbs. What plans do you have to make voting easier for all legally registered voters?
Well, Oklahoma has one of the best voting systems in any part of the country, any other state. We have other states that look at us for our voting system to see how it is. It's very secure. We have very minimal fraud and upset in that, and we actually know who we elected that evening. That's a great thing to know in our state. While as we go into this presidential election coming through November 5th, we will most likely not know who the president of the United States, simply because Georgia has already come on and said that they're going to hand count all their ballots. So it creates a challenge when that happens. When folks go to the voting polls or are eligible to vote, they have the opportunity of absentee ballots, absentee in person, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday on national elections and statewides, and then go to your polling place on Tuesday. So there's ample opportunity for you to exercise that right and vote and be able to do that as you see fit.
Okay. Carrie Keck, what plans do you have to make voting easier for all legally registered voters?
Well, I agree with Dell that we do have a very secure election system, and we have opportunities for people to be able to vote. I'm grateful that we have absentee ballots available for people, and we have early voting, which starts on October 30th. So if you haven't already voted, make sure you go and vote, preferably for Carrie Keck on October 30th. But the things that we could do to ensure that we are making voting easier is to, one of the things that's been suggested before and I think is a good idea, is to ensure or provide things like a time off, pay time, or allow employers to give their employees time off of work to go and vote. You know, I fought for 23 years for this country. I love our democracy, and I want everybody to be able to exercise their voice. And so making it easier, Oklahoma has one of the lowest voter turnout rates in the state, so in the nation. So making it easier to vote is always a great thing. So just finding ways, again, multiple different ways to make it easier for people to vote.
Okay. Thank you. Next question, first for Carrie Keck. What will you do to ensure that our state's restriction on a woman's right to make her own choices will go before a vote of the people?
That's a good question. So another great thing that we have here in Oklahoma is the ballot initiative petition process, right, which the legislature last session tried to get rid of. And so luckily that was able to be saved, but you know, as far as helping that get on the ballot, it would be a matter of, if it is about, is the question that it's whether or not it's a ballot initiative petition, or is it just on the ballot?
It says specifically before, so to go before a vote of the people.
Okay, got it. All right. So our legislature can actually pass bills to allow a vote of the people, right? There's a state question that's going to be on our ballot this that's on our current ballot that the legislature passed in order to allow citizens to be able to vote on it. So working with other legislators to get that on the ballot as a state question, I think, is what I would do.
Great. Same question to Dell Curbs. What will you do to ensure that our state's restriction on a woman's right to make her own choices will go before a vote of the people?
Well, kind of like Carrie talked about, we have an initiative petition process. The unfortunate part about the initiative petition process in the state of Oklahoma, it is very broad. So what happens is you get a lot of out-of-state interest that come in. Extremist groups from either side come into the state, and they can go in into specific areas, high-populated areas, tell you what you think you want to hear, get you to sign on it as you're walking out of Walmart, and get the signatures that they want to go and put it on the initiative petition. As the state, we're not trying to do away with the initiative petition. We're just trying to make that there's equal representation, because Shawnee should have a say in being able to know what's going on the ballot and what's not going on the ballot, not Oklahoma City and Tulsa. And as far as when we talk about the abortion, that's what we're talking about. Let's just call it what it is. Our state's stood very strong on where we are, and we are pro-life, and we talk about that. Nobody's questioning the choice of a woman, but what we seem to fail to question is what is the choice of the unborn child. And so that's what it comes down to.
Okay, thank you. Next question, first for Dell Curbs. Oklahoma is 49th in education and 44th in children's well-being. Pottawatomie County has a 20% poverty rate. For Representative Kerr specifically, what have you done in 8 years in office to address these issues?
Well, as I stated earlier, every bill that we've had that come up to fund and add additional funding into our school system, public school system, I have been in favor of. We have continued to vote in favor of moving funding to education to try to shore that up. Every time we make a move for the teachers as far as pay scale, then other states come in and compete with us on that at the same time. So it's a continual issue that we're going to continually battle. And as we do it, what's showing is money is not necessarily the solution. I'm not saying that we don't need to continue to fund our schools. What I'm saying is we need to start thinking outside the box and making sure that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and that's taking care of the student. When we have changed in a society where we put the responsibility of a teacher as being the parent for that child, both father and mother, grandparents, they're doing all of those things, the disciplinary, must make sure they get fed too. And we've taken that responsibility on in the school system, and we ask a teacher to do that at the same time trying to teach in the classroom. And that's not what the teacher was intended to do. She was intended, or he was intended to teach in the classroom, and that's what we want to be able to give them those freedoms. We have a poverty issue in Shawnee. Shawnee is a free and reduced 100%, and that's not something to be proud of. In order to take care of that situation, we've got to continue to work on our economic development in this community, because we're only as good as the lowest person that's getting paid in this community. And by doing that, we have to bring more quality jobs and more opportunity to increase on their household income. By doing that, then we can start to break that cycle of generational poverty and continue to start to see success rates. We have a lot of success rates in our school systems, both locally and statewide, that are coming. Yes, we continue to have challenges, and we are going to continue to have challenges. It's not a problem that we got into overnight, and we are definitely not going to get out of it overnight.
Thank you. Carrie Keck, Oklahoma is 49th in education and 44th in children's well-being, and Pottawatomie County has a 20% poverty rate. What would you do to address this if elected?
Well, to address our low ranking in education, we really have to invest in our schools. And that means we are also investing in our teachers. Our teachers and staff are still one of the lowest paid regionally. So we have to consider ways that we can invest in them. Our teachers shouldn't have to work multiple jobs and not be able to take care of their own kids to be able to take care of our kids, right? So we should be investing in our schools, ensuring that they're safe and that they're resourced and teachers are paid well, or our schools have enough resources that teachers don't have to pay for their own supplies out of their own pocket. We should be giving kids free meals in school. Studies show that when a kid is not hungry, they can better focus on getting an education. And that's what it's all about, right? Giving those kids a good education. My opponent talks about, you know, we've been taking care, or we need to take care of the student, but the legislature this last session did not. They refused to fund school meals. Our state superintendent of education is wanting to put $3 million this year into purchasing Bibles, and he's failed to address the hunger that we have in our classrooms, in our schools. And also the legislature didn't fund the counselor corps, right? So there are a lot of schools, especially in rural areas, that no longer have counselors. And with the mental health crisis that we have at every age, not just adults, but also in young kids, we've got to have counselors available in schools. Schools should be a safe place for kids to be, a place where they can go and maybe not have to worry so much about the challenges they have at home. So why don't we make sure they are fed at school, and why don't we have a counselor available for them to talk to about the things that they may be experiencing at home? So I think we have got to be doing that to help bring us up out of 49th in education, which is where we've been for a while now. I also think that we need to invest in economic development in our community with good paying jobs. We want Oklahoma to be our legislature wants Oklahoma to have the lowest corporate income tax rate in the United States. But that means the corporations aren't paying their fair share. Taxpayers are paying that burden too. And so our communities aren't being invested in, which means that corporations don't want to come here because we don't have the infrastructure they need to be able to, and an educated workforce that they need to be able to operate. So we have got to be doing those things, investing in our kids, investing in our communities, if we want to bring ourselves, Oklahoma, back up out of 49th in education and 44th in kids' well-being.
Thank you. Next question, first for Carrie Keck. Our governor has disputes with Oklahoma's tribal governments on many issues. How will your approach as a legislator be more productive?
We're very fortunate here in our area to have multiple tribal nations that really do the work of investing in our communities and working with our local government, the city of Shawnee, to identify the needs of the community and find ways to address those needs. They're investing in people who are not tribal members as well as tribal members because they've been here and they will always be here. And so they know that it's best when we work together as a community. So continuing to build on those relationships with tribal organizations, with tribal nations, and ensuring that they, with that good working relationship, we can benefit all Oklahomans.
Thank you. Del Curbs, our governor has disputes with Oklahoma's tribal governments on many issues. How will your approach as a legislator be more productive?
Well, you know, we do have several tribes in our area, and we continue to work with those tribes locally, and that's where it needs to be. Obviously, our governor, we see the disputes that are happening on the compacts, but we've had many compacts that have been signed and agreed to with tribes, and as we continue to work through those, we're going to. As with the compacts and with the governor, I don't agree with the governor on the fights with the tribes. He knows that. We've had multiple conversations in meetings on that talks about the compacts. He doesn't think it's the legislature's place to deal with the compacts. And we have to remind the governor and some of those folks that the legislature turned that over to the governor as a courtesy. We can pull that back at any time if we need to. But we'd like to have the negotiations done at the table when we talk about the compacts. And the biggest compact that they're having a discussion on is what the rate is that they're pulling off of the gambling. That goes straight to our kids, straight to the schools. So why wouldn't our governor be wanting to ask for more money from the tribes on their casino gamblings? Because that's where it ultimately ends up, is in the classroom. So I get it. It's just a difference of what that number is going to look like. We'll get there. It's going to happen. But it just takes time.
Thank you. All right, next question for Del Curbs. As a Republican, what values of your party do you believe will benefit the constituents in House District 26?
Well, I've always stayed true to my core values, which is pro-life. I'm on for guns. I enjoy going hunting and enjoy the guns. I enjoy the gun rights that we have the privilege in the U.S. to be able to do those. We need to make sure that we stay to our values and make sure we are where we want to be, which is where our constituency, the majority of the constituency, wants to be. I know we have differences on there, but I'm pretty sure at the end of the day, if I asked you if you're willing to kill a baby, I bet none of you would raise your hand. Obviously, that's not what we're talking about. The differences are whether that's a child at conception or once it's born. And that's a core value for me and the Republican Party. Other core values are keeping the taxes as low as we possibly can while creating the core functions that you've come to demand from your government. The other thing is making sure that government is there when you need them, not when they think you need them. And that's a big component for the party, Republican Party, is to make sure that we stay true to those facts.
Thank you. Carrie Keck, as a Democrat, what values of your party do you believe will benefit the constituents in House District 26?
Well, as a Democrat, one of the main reasons why I'm a Democrat is because I care about all people. Regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of your religion, regardless of your race, I care about hardworking people, working for hardworking people. That means having good paying jobs where people don't have to work multiple jobs to make ends meet. Helping people with things like a hand up instead of a hand out, right? So, finding ways to address the lack of childcare, finding ways to address the lack of transportation, finding ways to ensure that our schools are supported and safe and that our communities are safe. Sure, we can all agree on the fact that we have Second Amendment rights. I'm a gun owner as well, and I'm also a hunter. I prefer deer hunting. And, you know, as a military member, of course, I own guns and have utilized guns, but I think we can all agree on the fact that we have to have common sense. We need to think about guns in a common sense manner, right? So people who are experiencing mental health issues. Maybe they need limited access to their weapons until after they've been able to resolve those issues. People who have are domestic violence, people who have been convicted of domestic violence should not have access to guns, because the primary means they, when people are killed as a result of domestic violence, it's usually the primary method is guns, right? Same thing with suicide. The primary means of suicide, especially in the veteran population, is with guns. So we have got to find common sense solutions. We can't just say that there's nothing we can do and avoid making any effort to address it, right? So I'm all about helping people in a common sense way, and I'm helping people in common sense solutions, because I will always put people over politics as a as your representative.
Thank you. Next question, first for Carrie Keck. There are concerning teacher shortages in Oklahoma, and emergency teacher certificates are at an all-time high. Parents want real teachers in the classroom. As a legislator, what specific programs and actions would you implement or support to help with the solution?
That's a very good question. And as we've discussed before, teachers are, our teachers are some of the lowest paid regionally, right? So improving their pay, not just teachers, not just improving teacher pay, but also improving support staff pay, right? Because the teacher, the support staff helps the teacher be able to focus on giving kids a good education. So investing in our schools, investing in our teachers, ensuring that we are doing the things we need to make teachers feel that they are supported and that they are valued. We need to be valuing our teachers. That means not calling them members of terrorist organization. That means talking to them about the things that they need and the resources that we can provide them to ensure that our kids are getting a good education.
Thank you. Del Kerbs, same question. There are concerning teacher shortages in Oklahoma, and emergency teacher certificates are at an all-time high. Parents want real teachers in the classroom. As a legislator, what specific programs and actions will you implement or support to help with the solution?
Well, I appreciate the question. And you know, parents do want teachers in the classroom. They want qualified folks in the classroom. Just because it's a certified person doesn't mean that they're not qualified to teach. Some of the best teachers that are in our system are certified teachers. And so, you know, to embrace that component, we have a roughly a base of 50,000 teachers statewide that we're trying to staff up with our kids. We have 700,000 kids in the public school system in the state of Oklahoma. So that's a large working pool to try to continue to foster and get parents in there. One of the great things that's happening right here in our own community is OBU has created a program that will take a certified teacher and take them to that certified level on a fast track program. OBU is one of the most premier schools for education and turning out teachers. So it's awesome that they are being able to do it. I'd like to look at that model. We've been talking with Dr. Thomas to look at that model, to take that to a higher level, to the other higher institutions of learning, and start to work through that and continue to make sure that we are doing what we need to do in making sure that the money and the teachers are in the classroom. And it's a challenge out there. You know, the substitute amount of substitute teachers when we start going into spring sports, because we have teachers that are doing extra duty contracts, their coaches here, their assistant coaches there, and moving them in, it creates a real burden when in the buildings of our schools. You know, I used to work at the school district. I was on the support staff, and when spring would come, we would always be in the classroom as substitute teachers to try to help that. I'm not a certified teacher at all, but I'm an emergency certified so that I could go in there because I was an employee of the staff at the school district. And so by going into that classroom and being able to do those things, that's what we have to do to help support our teachers and be there when they need us to be there as well and make sure that they have the money. I don't like the idea of the teacher being able, that wants to go spend, that feels like they have to go spend their own money to go spend it on their classroom. We have great programs or great organizations here like Avitas that does things to help those, the banks that do those things to kind of help. There is money there. The schools give each one of the teachers in Shawnee, give them money to go buy specifically for their classroom. Is it enough? I can't answer that question. That's a question for your school board. That's why we have local control. Ask the school board some of these questions as well, because we can continue to throw money at it, but at the end of the day, the school board's the one that makes the decisions on where and how it's spent.
Thank you. Next question, first for Del Curbs. The No Sit, No Lie ordinance addressed homeless visibility in downtown Shawnee, but created issues in other parts of the city. What policies would you introduce at the state level to assist our communities to begin to solve the homeless issue on a permanent basis?
Well, homelessness is not just being without a home. Let's just put that to the wayside. Homelessness has so many facets between mental health, addiction, and homelessness, and so many other things. And we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to bolster those organizations that are trying to help take care of that situation through mental health. We've funded this last budget cycle, we put $12.5 million in specific to mental health to go directly to the counties and work that process. Do we want to put more money? Absolutely. We couldn't get to the agreement to move it up to another amount of money with the Senate this year, but we're going to continue to fight that battle. We also have to look at addiction. Addiction is a massive situation that we're dealing with, and the single largest killer in our young folks in the U.S. is fentanyl. Guess where fentanyl is coming from? It's coming across the border. And when we have the issues with the border that we're having, it becomes an issue for the state. State of Oklahoma is working with the state of Texas and Arizona and New Mexico to try to bolster and stop some of the illegal issues that we're having coming up, the drug pushing, the trafficking, not the child trafficking specifically, but all of those in the trafficking of human trafficking, trying to deal with those situations. That all ultimately goes back into where we are with homelessness because of the addiction, because of mental health. And yes, we do have a housing shortage of both low income, affordable, reasonable, you name it. There's 4 million houses available on the market right now in the entire United States. And that's not a sustainable model for housing right now. So we have to continue to look at that. We did last session, we pushed $215 million into the Housing Authority to try to bolster, to help with building houses and getting those things done. Are we looking at continuing to do some kind of funding? Absolutely, because the idea is to get people into home ownership that they can do that. And that goes all the way up. And making sure to support our programs that are in doing hand-up programs and not handout programs.
Thank you. Carrie Keck, the No Sit, No Lie ordinance addressed homeless visibility in downtown Shawnee, but created issues in other parts of the city. What policies would you introduce at the state level to assist our communities to begin to solve the homeless issue on a permanent basis?
Homelessness is very much an issue in Shawnee, but across Oklahoma. And I've heard that from so many people in our community, that thousands of doors that we knocked. So many people, especially in this area of town, have said, expressed their frustration with the ordinance, because really all it did, it didn't address the underlying issues, it just moved people from one place to the other. So now those individuals are in neighborhoods, and there's an impact to those neighborhoods. So ignoring the problem is doing nothing, and it won't make it any better. In fact, as my friend Jamie always likes to say, it's like a snowball, right? So if we just let it keep rolling, it's just going to keep getting bigger, and without addressing it, without trying to stop it, without finding ways to stop it, it's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and wrap more people up into it. So the reality is that most Americans are 1 to 2 paychecks away from homelessness. And there are many ways that we can impact the issue, but it starts with the willingness to address it. And as Mr. Kerbs mentioned, creating affordable housing, incentivizing builders to build affordable housing, and that includes low interest rate loans for building affordable housing. If we increase the supply, hopefully we can keep the prices in check. And it's also investing in mental health care and addiction treatment resources. Mr. Kerbs mentioned that in the legislature provided $12 million this last session for mental health and drug treatment. Well, in 2016, when we passed State Question 780 and 781, the legislature was supposed to use all of the savings from those from the changes that occurred as a result of those state questions to fund mental health and drug treatment resources. And our state estimated, our state loft or, sorry, our state, it's estimated that we have $23 million of savings from that state question, right? The legislature only funded $12 million of that. So where is the rest of that money going when it's really supposed to be given to communities to invest in mental health and substance abuse treatment facilities, as well as diversion programs? Where is that money going? We need that money in our communities, and it's up to the legislature to do the things that voters told them they wanted them to do.
Yeah, thank you. Next question, first for Carrie Keck. Turnpikes have existed in Oklahoma since the 1950s. Toll roads are an affordable way for governments to build new roads. How can we ensure the existing turnpikes are paid off before new ones are built that add to the combined debts on the turnpikes?
Turnpikes, while they're nice to have, because you can drive, 75 on turnpikes and avoid a lot of the congestion and traffic, but it's not nice to have, it's not nice on your pocketbook. And if we continue to fund turnpikes, which we're supposed to have paid for themselves, if we continue to fund those, then that just means we're paying even more to drive on our roads, right? Taxpayers are paying the burden of maintaining those turnpikes, even though they're supposed to pay for themselves. So it's a matter of working with the Department of Transportation to identify the needs that we actually have and ensure that when there's an environmental impact study done, that it's actually utilized to determine where turnpikes go so that it minimizes the impact to the community and still maximizes the use of our, the efficient use of our taxpayer dollars. Having a point where we get a good return on investment, right? And so that we're not continuing to pay for these toll roads and the maintenance of these toll roads when that's not what they were originally established for.
Okay, thank you. Dale Kerbs. Turnpikes have existed in Oklahoma since the 1950s. Toll roads are an affordable way for governments to build new roads. How can we ensure that existing turnpikes are paid off before new ones are built that add to the combined debts on the turnpike?
Well, turnpikes are a necessity. We have to have them. Do we agree on what the price we pay? I don't think anybody enjoys paying the turnpike fees, but we sure do enjoy using those as a straight access. And going through, they have continual maintenance. We have a high traffic load. The wonderful part about being the state of Oklahoma is the turnpikes, of which that do have a fee, have an on average 40% as what we call tourism, means people passing through the state. So 40% of out-of-state folks pay to utilize our roads, which only helps us when we're bolstering on roads and bridges and things along that line to utilize that. So the Oklahoma Turnpike and the Oklahoma Turnpike, or the ODOT, which is Oklahoma Department of Transportation, and the Oklahoma Turnpike Authority are two different divisions that are underneath one director. But they have two different defines of what they do. The Oklahoma Turnpike Authority is just that. Builds, develops, and defines turnpikes. When turnpikes are built, then you see commerce, you see more traffic as far as freight usage, and you see more communities that are able to build on that. Our community alone, even though we don't have a paid turnpike, we have the interstate, Interstate 40. Where's most of the development happening for our community? It's on Interstate 40. Tecumseh's not getting it. And the reason is because those businesses want to be close to those folks that are passing through. When those people pass through, they stop, they buy gas, they buy something to eat, they use sales tax, and guess what? Then they go on. So they're not putting a strain on our local folks as far as the infrastructure and those needs. They're actually paying, stopping, enjoying themselves for that time, and heading on. And the cities and local municipalities, as well as just like the Turnpike Authority, gets to utilize those funds on our behalf. So there are challenges, and we talk about it all the time, but the turnpikes are heavily trafficked, so they do have a maintenance requirement on them. Do I wish that Oklahomans would be able to travel free? Absolutely. Is a turnpike ever paid off? It is not, because the continual maintenance continues.
Yeah, thank you. Next question, first for Dale Kerbs. Oklahoma is trying to rein in pharmacy benefit managers to help their independent pharmacists stay afloat and reduce the formulary restrictions and add additional costs for our taxpayers. Regardless of how the Supreme Court decides on this question, what other plans do you have to help us?
Well, that's a great question. I actually ran a PBM bill two sessions ago, actually, and we moved it through. And that was specifically for our independent pharmacists to start getting our insurance commissioner, because unfortunately what we had was the fox guarding a hen house, and not in a good way in this situation. And so we needed to move that over to the authority of the AG, because what happens, CVS, I'm going to pick on CVS for a minute. They sent out and put a scare tactic out, a letter that said, you know, you're going to lose all your benefits. You're not going to be able to get your prescription drugs here because of who your company has chosen to go with your medical providers. And so that was just one tactic of many that was being used by these PBMs to try to direct where you buy your prescription drugs. And once they direct them there, then how much you pay. So by working that and taking that authority and moving it from the insurance commission's office over to the AG's office, now we've got the most powerful litigator in the state of Oklahoma trying these cases, and he's been doing it very successfully and putting them in the box and finding them and getting these PBMs back in check with us, which is who is ultimately paying the healthcare bills when we go to see these doctors and get these prescriptions at our pharmacists. And our independent pharmacists are phenomenal folks. If you don't use an independent pharmacist, you need to, because they know exactly, and they'll question sometimes in the medical side, they'll miss something when that prescription comes down. And your independent pharmacist is more likely to catch that than your mainstream Walmarts or folks along that line. So as we continue to work that, that's a big thing. But we've got the right person guarding that hen house now, and he's going to continue to make sure that we're doing what we need to do to hold them accountable.
Thank you. Kerry Keck, Oklahoma is trying to rein in pharmacy benefit managers to help their independent pharmacists stay afloat and reduce the formulary restrictions and additional costs for our taxpayers. Regardless of how the Supreme Court decides in this question, what other plans do you have to help us?
Well, I think supporting our small businesses and our local businesses it's a very important thing, and something that the legislature should be willing to work towards. Big box stores have really put some of our small pharmacies out of business. It's just they have much more bargaining power, and they can really have more of an impact, especially a place like Walmart. There are a lot more people that traffic those stores on a daily basis. So as far as trying to help our small pharmacies, I think that was the question, help them stay afloat. I'm no expert in the way that pharmacies are run, but what I would do as a legislator is actually talk to the people in that community that are impacted by those costs and find ways, get suggestions from them on ways that we could address those issues, and then work with other legislators to get that legislation passed.
Thank you. Next question, first for Kerry Keck. What is your opinion or position on Ryan Walters?
This is a nice question.
Short to
sweet. Well, our state superintendent of education has been in the news lately. It's really made Oklahoma be in the news lately for some pretty not so nice things. I think that, you know, again, I've knocked on over 10,000 doors in our community and had thousands of conversations with people, and the vast majority of people tell me that they can't stand our superintendent of education, and they ask me, what can you do? When can we get him out? Like, can you get him out of office? And so there's obviously a challenge there because he's an elected official, but I think that we should be supporting our teachers, and we should be supporting our schools. And his job as the superintendent of education is to find ways to ensure that our school districts have what they need in order to give our kids a good education. I don't think he's focused on that. I think he's focused on making a name for himself in a larger political office, and which is very unfortunate because our schools and our kids are the ones that are impacted.
Thank you. Dale Kerbs, what is your opinion or position on Ryan Walters?
Well, you know, I've said it many a times. I wish Ryan Walters would get off the campaign trail and actually do the job that he was elected to do. But at the same time, he is a statewide elected official. And just because he does things that we don't necessarily care for and those kind of things doesn't make him impeachable, which is what a lot of people want to talk about. So we have our challenges. More communication would be nice at times with him. He has started communicating with the legislative body a lot more as we work through this. This last session, we moved on a line item budget that is specific to the entire budget instead of just giving a blanket and moving those directions to try to help in the ways with him over there at SDE. I do like some of the things that he's doing to bring more awareness, and he is taking care of some of the bad actors that are in our education system. And that doesn't mean that they are all bad actors. And trying to remind everybody that the vast majority, 99% of what's in our education system is phenomenal. They are great folks. But we do have a percentage that are bad players, and we need to take care of those. And he has been doing that part of the job. But sometimes he gets in it wound up and wants to group everybody together. But he is working with the legislative body a lot more. We're working through the budget cycle on that, and we'll get there. It's just going to take some time.
All right, thank you. Next question, first for Dale Kerbs. What is your stance on the energy transmission corridor and on biosolids?
Well, the ROFR, which is what we're kind of talking about, there is some out-of-state companies that are wanting to come in and do high transmission lines. While we've got OG&E and PSO, which are regulated companies in the state of Oklahoma, that want to have first right of refusal, which is what the ROFR is, on there. And so we've been having this debate back and forth at the state level. And at the end of the day, I'm much more comfortable with a regulated company that they have strings attached to that we can rein in if there's an issue, versus what the opposing sides are wanting to do is just go they call it the thousand up, which is a federal side. And if you do that, if you look at what the federal's done, and that then literally it's the sky's the limit, meaning that our transmission lines, which are the high-powered lines that then diverse down and come in, the smaller lines then come into our community, and then the smaller ones come to our house. That gives an opportunity for our electrical grid infrastructure to be bought by a foreign government, by a foreign entity. And I am not okay with that. So for us to be able to keep strings attached to regulation for the PSO and the OG&E companies, and that are working with us, that we see those folks every day because we see them, they live, work, and play in our communities, I think that's an important factor for us to keep in mind as we talk about these transmission lines. The bio-waste, that is a challenge. We are fully under EPA and DEQ regulations, both at the federal and state level. Are there concerns that we want to talk about? Absolutely. But we need to take into consideration that this happens every single day right here in our community. Full regulations are being adhered to. And our city itself does a biosludge spread to make sure that their plants are continuing to operation. Because at the end of the day, when we flush the toilet, we want to make sure it doesn't come up back up into our bathrooms or into our houses. We want to make sure that that goes, and we don't care where it goes as long as it's not in our house. And so that's the challenges we have. As we continue to look at that, are there going to be better practices that come out of that? Absolutely. But we have to learn and move those things. But we are in full compliance of what's happening currently with the state and across even our locality or local government.
Thank you. Carrie Keck, what is your stance on the energy transmission corridor and on biosolids?
This is a very interesting question, and I have to admit that I am not well versed in biosolids in the energy transmission corridor. So I would have to find out more information on that before I could really take a stance. I would like to say, though, that as far as bio-waste is concerned or any waste product, ensuring that we are holding companies, especially big corporations, accountable for disposing of their waste properly to ensure that it's not running into our waterways. When we have significant rain events, that is polluting our waterways. So ensuring that companies are doing their job and disposing of their waste properly. But as far as the energy transmission lines, I would have to research that before being able to provide an actual answer.
Thank you. Next question, first for Carrie Keck. How can we keep our kids safe in schools?
Well, we can ensure, you know, there are ways to keep our kids safe in school. It's ensuring that we have school resource officers in every school, and our state superintendent of education, our legislature actually passed legislation to require a certain amount of funding go to each of the schools for security upgrades, and holding our state superintendent of education accountable to, the legislature was able to hold him accountable to actually providing those resources to the schools as he as was necessary. But giving our schools the things that they need to improve their safety and
Okay. Del Kerbs, how can we keep our kids safe in schools?
Well, you know, it's always a concern. Schools are a target just by their nature because they're kids and there's teachers in the classroom that are focused on the kids. We did at the legislative body move $150 million over the next 3 years, $50 million each year, and every single school district gets $90,000 of that, give or take in that range, that $90,000. That's going to help for SROs, which are security resource or safety resource officers, which are our police officers that are in the schools to help maintain the security levels. If they already had SROs in the school system, they were allowed to utilize that towards security measures, whether that be passcodes and lockdowns on the door system, or breezeways and security breezeways, where the two-door system, so a visitor can come in the first door, talk with the office, and then get clearance to go on in or not go on in. We did have a hiccup with the State Department of Education. The legislative intent was to make sure that the schools were utilizing those dollars annually, and the State Department of Ed sent out a memo that said you could bank those for the 3 years and use it for a bigger project. And that was not the legislative intent. But that had went out, and some schools had decided, well, we have our SROs and we want to put in a larger camera system that's going to cost us $150,000. So they wanted to bank that money for the first year and move it towards the second. We worked through that process to be able to work with the schools and with the State Department of Education and be able to, so that schools could be able to utilize that and not lose those fundings, because that was not the legislative intent. We have overcome that hurdle, and schools are now understand how they're supposed to utilize those funds and get those funds, because we want to make sure that schools are utilizing those funds to protect our kids.
Thank you. Before we go on, I want to say that we've gotten a lot of great questions from all of you tonight. We really appreciate it. We are running out of time, so we're not going to be able to get to all of them. We have time for two more questions that we're going to do. So for Carrie Keck, supporters of House Bill 1934, the private school and homeschool tax credit bill enacted into law in 2023, said it would grant opportunity to low-income families. But according to a news story by Channel 4 in June of this year, about one-third of families receiving the tax credit from the state of Oklahoma for sending their children to private schools make more than $150,000 a year. What additional protection for low-income participation needs to be added?
Well, you know, I understand the legislature's intent, but the reality is that 2 years before, or a few years before they passed that bill in 2023, voters overwhelmingly said that they did not want they did not want private school vouchers. But the legislature passed the bill anyway, which means that we're providing over $600 million in public taxpayer funds to fund private schools. And these are schools that most kids in our community don't have access to. We only have one private school in Shawnee and one just north of town. So two schools in our entire district. And it's just not accessible for the majority of people. And not to mention the fact that a third of the families that used the tax credit last year, which were supposed to be utilized for lower income families, a third of the families made over $150,000. There are not that many families in our area that make $150,000 a year. So the transparency in who is actually obtaining those, who's actually able to submit applications for those credits, the reality is that I think that we should discontinue utilization of those credits. But if we're going, it's already a bill, right? So if we're going to continue to do that, we have to make sure that it's transparent and that it's fair, that people who are the intended recipients are the ones who are actually getting to use those taxes, or getting to use those credits.
Thank you. Del Curbs. Supporters of House Bill 1934, the Private School and Homeschool Tax Credit Bill enacted into law in 2023, said it would grant opportunity to low-income families. But according to a new story on Channel 4 from June this year, about one-third of the families receiving a tax credit from the state of Oklahoma for sending their children to private schools make more than $150,000 a year. What additional protection for low-income participation needs to be added?
Well, as we continue to look at that, it is going to be an evolving challenge, I should say, on there. But, you know, even in the way the question stated, one-third of families receiving a tax credit from the state of Oklahoma are sending their children to private schools make more than $150,000 a year. That alone tells you that the program's working for the grant opportunities for lower-income families, because two-thirds are on the other side. So keep that in mind when we're talking about that. So as we continue to work through it, do we need to look at what's going on with that one-third? Sure. Let's take a look at it and see what's going on. The amount, it's capped. It's capped at $250 million. So when we hit that cap, there are no more tax credits, because we don't want it to be a burden onto the system as we figure out how it works. So as we continue to go through this process, we need to continue to look at that. But at the end of the day, this is talking about parent choice. The parent's right that pays the taxes for their child to go to different organizations, whether they're low income or they're hitting this $150,000. They're all paying into the system. But yes, we can look at that and see why there's a one-third, and see what we can do to help facilitate that. But two-thirds of lower income folks are being able to take utilize that opportunity. So I look at that as a success as you roll the program out.
Thank you. Next question, first for Del Curbs. A multi-county grand jury has not yet filed criminal indictments, but did find Governor Kevin Stitt's administration and State Superintendent Ryan Walters carried out, quote, grossly negligent handling of federal pandemic aid funds, unquote. Do you support their recommendation that a state agency receiving federal grant money should establish mandatory and ongoing training requirements in federal grant administration?
Absolutely. I mean, we have that in place when you have nonprofits and organizations that are applying for those. They have to go through continuational training as they use those. We do that with state grants too. Why we don't have that is a question that really needs to be asked. And it's been brought to our attention through this grand jury findings, and it will be something that will be acted on, because that's, to me, is not acceptable at any level in any of our agencies. But we do some training. Now, the downfall is, in the State Department of Education, they've had a high turnover of employees. So I'm sure we've had some issues there, just like you would in any business if you had a high turnover of employees. We're going to have some mistakes. But are we going to learn from those mistakes? Absolutely.
Okay. Kerry Keck, a multi-county grand jury has not yet filed criminal indictments, but did find Governor Kevin Stitt's administration and State Superintendent Ryan Walters carried out grossly negligent handling of federal pandemic aid funds. Do you support the recommendation that a state agency receiving federal grant money should establish mandatory and ongoing training requirements in federal grant management?
Yes, I think that there should be significant training done in federal grant management, and that we have the right people in place that know how to monitor and maintain those grants. It's taxpayer, we're talking about taxpayer dollars, and so there should always be some accountability of those dollars. And right now we have seen a lack of transparency and accountability in our state government on many aspects, to include those pandemic relief funds and how they were utilized to support schools. I think that in order to have a functioning government, the people need to know what's happening in that government. The only way we can do that is through transparency and holding people accountable that misuse our taxpayer dollars. That's not necessarily happening right now, and we need change, and that's why so many people in our community have told me that they are ready for change. They're tired of the people that are misusing and abusing the system, and they are ready for change, and I want to be that change.
Thank you. All right, that's it for our questions. At this point, we're going to let each candidate give a closing statement. They have 1 minute for a closing statement, and Del Kerbs will give the first closing statement.
Well, thank you. Again, I appreciate PAVE for putting on this forum, and I especially want to say thank you to the folks of House District 26. You know, we've been through our ups and downs as a community and at the state, from a deficit to a surplus, and we're going to continue to make progress day in and day out. You know, that's the great thing about democracy as a whole, is we get to be able to do these things. We get to be able to say the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, I want to publicly say I appreciate Kerry for serving her country for 23 years and being able to come back and be here and do those kind of great things. And as we go through, remember, it doesn't matter who you vote for on November 5th, but just remember, it's a privilege you get to vote. And I will ask for your vote on November 5th. And thank you guys very much.
Thank you. Kerry Keck, 1 minute for your closing statement.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight and to answer the questions and address your concerns as voters in House District 26. As I mentioned, we've knocked over 10,000 doors in our community since January 1st because I care about the people in our community and what they want from their elected officials. I've had conversations with people across the district, and what I hear most is that people haven't seen results in the 8 years that my opponent has been in office. We have to hold legislators accountable for their actions or inaction, and we do that by using our voice and our vote. As your state representative, I will always listen to the people of our district and put their needs first. I will work hard every single day for the voters in this community because we deserve it. So I'm asking you to put me to work for the people of House District 26 and vote for Kerry Keck for House District 26 on November 5th.
Thank you. Well, I think the only other thing to do is remind everyone that the election is Tuesday, November 5th. One thing we'll all agree on is we should all be there if you haven't already voted. So just remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Thank you all for coming.